Hello, I'm Chloe McCulloch, Buildings Editor, and I'm here with...
Me, Elizabeth Hopkirk. I'm Assistant Editor on Building Design.
Welcome to Episode 6 of the Building Talks Net Zero podcast, a series looking at how the built environment can help us hit the UK's net zero carbon targets. Construction can help save the planet. It already has the knowledge and much of the technology that can set us on the path to net zero. Building Talks focuses on the people with the positive ideas and technical know-how that can help the built environment reach its carbon goals. So Elizabeth, what have we got coming up today?
Well, Chloe, as this is the final episode of the series, we're packing lots in for a bit of a bumper edition today. We'll be talking to two people from the engineering firm Webb Yates about key construction materials and the potential to reuse or recycle materials like concrete, steel and even stone. And we'll also hear from Edmund Fowles and Fergus Fielden, co-founders of Field & Fowles, a practice that's co-located with a farm, and we'll be down on the farm later in the episode.
And of course, we have our final Jargon Buster session with Simon Wyatt at Cundall. This week, he zooms in on another hot topic, heat pumps and the strategies we need to decarbonise how we heat buildings. And we'll have a roundup of the week in Net Zero News. That's all coming up in the Building Talks Net Zero podcast. Hello and welcome to our listeners. Thanks for listening. We're recording this episode in Field & Fowles offices at Waterloo in central London. Now, we've recorded this podcast in some very interesting locations over the series, but I think it's safe to say that this is the first time we've been in such proximity to a working farm. Yes, Waterloo City Farm is attached to the Field & Fowles studio. So clearly it's a unique office and an interesting architectural practice. Elizabeth, it feels very different, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a beautiful place to be on a lovely autumnal day like this, isn't it, with the sun streaming in. There's a lovely story behind why Field & Fowles are co-located with a city farm, and we'll hear from Ed and Fergus about that later on. And we're also going to go on a little tour of the farmyard and meet some of the animals.
Well, it's great to be here, and we'll hear from Edmund and Fergus later on. But for now, let's get started with some net zero news. So first off, Elizabeth, I think the thing that caught my eye was the Prime Minister announcing plans for up to, I think it's around 145,000 extra charging points for electrical vehicles across England each year. So that sounds quite ambitious. And I know he himself, Boris Johnson, I'm saying here, described that as a pivotal moment in advancing the infrastructure for electrical vehicles ahead of this key date, which is 2030, when the sale of new petrol and diesel cars will come to an end in the UK.
That's right, Chloe. But there's been a backlash from house builder groups who describe it as a stealth tax, while others feel it's unfair that energy companies will benefit while developers and their customers pay the price.
Yeah, you can see their point, I think, that this infrastructure is falling on the developers. And I think one of the organisations that sort of had sent out a press release complaining about this announcement was one of the organisations representing the smaller developers. So they will definitely feel it in their pocket. I suppose the other side of it is someone's got to pay, and it is an infrastructure, an element of infrastructure, and we as a country have to find a way to pay. I don't think developers are going to get a lot of sympathy in government circles that they shouldn't be there to stump up on this point. But you know, I think it's one of those things where we'll see how big the row gets. But it's certainly encouraging to see that a plan for charging points for electrical vehicles is getting underway at scale. The other news that caught my attention from last week was the news that Westminster Council has approved plans to demolish the Oxford Street M&S store. Elizabeth, you know quite a bit about this one, don't you? It's quite controversial.
That's right, yes. Campaigners are up in arms about the idea of demolishing this rather cherished building near Marble Arch and a couple of its less cherished neighbours. It's M&S's sort of flagship building. So a lot of people, a lot of listeners, I'm sure, have done Christmas shopping and things there. Oxford Street is facing a bit of a existential crisis with changing patterns in retail. And so M&S's argument is that they want to replace this ageing building, they'd say, beautiful building, others might say, with an office-led scheme. And Pilbara and Partners has just won planning permission for its replacement. There's a slight caveat, and that's that heritage groups are trying to get the building listed at the moment, the central Orchard Street building, and so if it's listed, then Westminster and the developer will have to think again.
Okay, so watch this space. So we've just been hearing about the issue of whether to demolish or reuse existing buildings. And that very issue came up in an interview we did earlier with the engineering firm Webb Yates. We spoke to Associate Anna Beckett and Director Tom Webster from the company. It's built up a reputation over the years for finding creative and sustainable engineering solutions. We wanted to talk to them about how they approach the main construction materials of concrete and steel, which are known for being carbon intensive, and how they try to think differently about the use, reuse, and recycling of materials in general. So, let's take a listen to what they had to say.
Well, yes, Chloe, we've got Anna Beckett and Tom Webster from Webb Yates Engineers, which, as you know, has got a reputation for being at the sort of fun and creative end of engineering, and for prioritising environmental considerations. Two notable projects. I think you put a boating lake on the roof of Selfridges, and you were the engineers on 15 Clock and Well Close, which was shortlisted for the Stirling Prize, and was also threatened with demolition by the council, who got upset. We're mostly going to talk about materials, not just fossil-rich stones, but steel and concrete, and how we can reuse materials as well as more innovative new materials. But first of all, let's just hear a little bit about you both. Anna, tell us kind of who you are, what your professional background is, and what does sustainability mean to you?
Hi. Yeah, so I am an associate at Webb Yates, and I have worked there for just over 10 years. And the boating lake on the roof of Selfridges was actually one of my first projects at Webb Yates. It was also bright green, a very fun project. But yeah, in that time, I've worked on a huge range of different things, some very unusual kind of temporary projects, and some of the more conventional projects, office refurbs, residential projects, and some airport work. And now we're doing a lot more work where we're really trying to push low carbon solutions, and I think that that's really important. It's the biggest issue for everyone, I think, today. And it's something that I think is really important, and something that I think as structural engineers we can make a huge difference to. I think it's like 40% of the carbon emissions are from the construction industry, and so I think it's really important that we try to do whatever we can. So we have at Webb Yates an internal working group called the Planeteers, where we're trying to find ways for the company to do more to work in a more low carbon way, and propose solutions to the company, to everybody, for ways that they can work to achieve that.
Brilliant, thank you. And Tom, tell us, who are you and what does sustainable design mean?
Hi, yeah, so I'm Tom Webster. I'm one of the directors at Webb Yates. I joined Webb Yates in 2015, and I joined from ACOM, where I'd been since I graduated, which feels like a very long time ago now. You know, I think primarily for me, the drive for personally to be sustainable comes really from like quite a humble background growing up, where, you know, my dad would often be tinkering with various things around the house and reusing bits of, you know, wood and structure and, you know, other things to create something else. And I think that's often gone through into my personal engineering. And I think more recently, having now got young kids, I don't feel like I can talk to my kids about my job without the guilt of knowing I'm not doing what I can to protect a future for future generations coming forward. And I think that's quite a core important driver for me.
And presumably better than anything else almost is to reuse the materials in a building that's being rebuilt, or tell us a bit about how we can. Why are we not doing that? First of all, the steel comes out and it's in perfectly good order, isn't it? Why aren't we reusing it?
Yeah. Well, I, first of all, I actually think better than reusing the materials is to reuse the building and find a way to reuse the building without actually taking everything out or demolishing the building. And that's something that we would try and push for on a lot of our projects. But yes, if you are going to take down the building, then there is a lot of material in it that you should theoretically be able to reuse. And yes, steel in particular, we have standard steel section sizes, we have standard steel grades. So it would seem sensible that if you're taking out a set of steelwork that you know what size it is and you know what grade it is, you should be able to reuse it. And yet, actually, there are a lot of things that stop you from being able to do that. At the moment, the certification that you need for the steelwork is quite difficult to get past if you don't have the original certificates for the steel, which if your building is more than 10 years old, you almost certainly don't. Even if it's 2 years old, you still might not have that information.
Because people just lose it.
Yeah. We've spent so much time looking through archive drawings trying to find this information. And some places have that information much better than others. Actually, the airports are very good at keeping their record drawings, or they at least have them, even if they're not organised in a particularly logical way. But other buildings that we work with often don't have anything at all, or what they do have is a set of architectural plans with none of the structural information. And so actually it becomes very difficult to know, firstly, how that building was designed, and secondly, what those materials actually are. And the steel testing certificates, they might never have been in the O&M manual or anything like that. The contractor probably had them and they didn't go any farther than that. And yeah, in the Eurocodes, they are expecting you to have some traceability of the materials to be able to use those steels. Without the testing certificates, you have no way of knowing where that steel came from, or how it was put together, or what testing has been undertaken on it.
So how could we move on from this problem?
So I think there is now a code that sets out how you can reuse existing steelwork, and sets out the testing that you need to do. So there is a process for that. The testing that you have to do is quite involved, but you can theoretically do it. But then, yes, we get into other issues of if you've taken a lot of steelwork out of a building that's not necessarily the sizes that you want to put back into that building, and somebody has to find somewhere to keep it, and you have to find a way of working with it. But I don't think that those are obstacles you can't overcome. I just think you have to be prepared to work in a different way.
Is one of the big issues that all of that costs more?
Yes, I think at the moment that is a big issue, that it costs more, and it's quite often cited as one of the reasons why you wouldn't reuse it. And yet I think that that's the sort of thing that the more it starts to happen, the more the cost will reduce and the more feasible it becomes. But you have to start somewhere.
I think the problem with a lot of the sustainable talks, when we're talking to people about sustainable, people are going, this is going to cost me money, going to cost me money. Everything gets monetized at the end of the day. That's the kind of the impact of the kind of commercial world we live in. There are so many opportunities here for so many companies within the construction industry to change their direction, but not necessarily change how profitable they are and how their turnovers are. There's growth through changing your business to become a more competitive, sustainable company and deliver sustainable buildings.
And spotting the opportunities for...
Absolutely. It's just about being a little bit, thinking outside the box, being a bit more creative and thinking through those problems, you know. And to me, the steelwork industry, and somebody asked me the same question about stone, and we've not really spoken too much about stone, but, you know, could stone be a more mainstream material? And I'm like, well, absolutely it could, but it needs investment.
I was just going to see if we move on to another material that is a big headache for construction because we use it a lot, which is concrete, and specifically cement within concrete. Is that something that you scratch your heads about a lot?
We scratch our heads, but ultimately there are very few other materials that work in the same way as concrete. In the, you know, it's very difficult to not do concrete foundations, especially on some of the mega buildings that we work on. The good thing about concrete is at the moment there is relatively old technology that you can use to reduce carbon footprint. So everybody uses GGBS and PFA, which are effectively waste materials from generation of power from gas-fired power stations. So there's a limited life on those materials. But by using those, and when I say it's old technology, these cement replacements were used, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago to reduce the internal temperature of concrete so it didn't cure so quickly. So, you know, if you think about bake-off fans, you know, if you don't get your cake mix right and you put it in the oven and it cools too quickly on the outside and it's still warm in the middle, then your cake will collapse and crack. And it's the same with concrete. So if you're pouring a really thick lump of concrete, if your external part of your concrete cools quicker than your internal part, then you'll get stress cracking within your concrete. So what you use is you remove the cementitious material, which creates that thermal reaction, exothermic reaction within the concrete, and you replace that with other cementitious type materials, PFA, GGBS, which effectively create a concrete that is takes longer to cure because the temperatures are lower, but ultimately you end up with a better product. You get a more durable concrete with these additives put in. And you get a concrete that doesn't, you know, pull itself apart effectively. So that's old technology. So what a lot of companies are doing at the moment is to, you know, put a high percentage of cement replacements within your concrete. It's not a sustainable practice in that we can't do it indefinitely because ultimately we will run out of those materials at some point. Because
you're
hopefully
about those waste materials that
correct,
are coming
so
from
we will look at coal. You know, we need to stop the, obviously everybody signed up now with COP to hopefully reducing or removing coal. You know, we need to do the same with gas, so actually that product will go over time. So there are other products that are coming out into the marketplace. I was listening, I think it was Radio 5 the other week, and they had somebody on from Manchester University talking about, I can't remember exactly what they called it. I think they called it concretine, which was a mix of concrete and graphene, which was a really interesting thing because, you know, graphene is effectively carbon. So you can take carbon and layer it into your concrete. They've developed a method of doing that in a way that it bonds to the concrete. So you can significantly reduce your cement content within there. And the other benefit is the graphene has a tensile property to it, so you can also reduce potentially the amount of reinforcement you put in. So it's win-win. And so, you know, we are reliant in the industry on some very smart people who work at the universities around the world doing, you know, R&D on these things and realizing that you can take this new material and combine it with this old material and create something that's really quite sustainable.
Can you see stone being used widely?
I can see the benefits for it being used widely. The issue with stone, as I see it, and I think the company sees it, and actually our collaborators in the market, you know, Stonemasonry Company and other stonemasons that are out there, and a lot of the work we do with Amin Taha and group work, it's how do you scale up the manufacturing and production? Because, you know, stonemasonry is a I don't want to call it a cottage industry, I'll get shot for saying that, but it's a traditional skill. It's lots of small companies.
Slow architecture.
So it's lots of small companies, and so to upscale that, you need investment.
What are the benefits of stone?
Oh, how long have you got?
Okay. Not that long.
Okay, stone is on average at least 6 to 10 times stronger than concrete in terms of its compressive. It's got 3 times as much tensile capacity. It is a stable material in that it doesn't change shape or dimension with temperature change, with time, with moisture content, or really under load. So whereas concrete will shrink as it dries out, it will then expand and contract with thermal movements. You get long-term creep deformations within your concrete if it's spanning. Makes it a bit of a headache. And so it's a very good material.
Is it not very heavy to transport?
It is heavy.
Right.
It is heavy, but if you size your stone appropriately, it's no more or less heavy than a very big heavy steel beam. So yes, there are, you know, you have to have some level of craneage with it. But again, it's about understanding the limitations of your project. So if you think...
But you think it has carbon benefits?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the carbon footprint of stone, it's tiny. I'm trying to think what we calculated on the stone for Clerkenwell World Close, but it's about 10% of what you'd get from concrete.
And presumably you can reuse stone very easily.
Correct, and it's obviously naturally occurring. There is so much stone in the world, it can be locally sourced. Interestingly, it can also be your finish. So we have a big thing on wastage, and we don't like waste in buildings, so we don't like finishes if you don't need them. So if you can design something that has texture or materiality or inherent architecture and beauty to it, why don't you just use it like a timber, like a stone, even concrete? You know, why are we covering up concrete walls with plasterboard?
And I wanted to ask, it takes us back in a way, but concrete, can that be, how easily can that be reused, or can you only use it in situ, like the foundations?
So yeah, I mean, it's in terms of circular economy, we very much see it as a downwards recyclable material. So over time, it becomes not less useful, but its properties deteriorate. So you break it up, you might put it in a road, put it under a building, yeah, hardcore, etc. I did read something at some point, and my memory's addled by having two young kids and not having any sleep, that I think they were looking at, you know, effectively creating concrete as a chemical reaction. So there is a change in the cement, the bonds, you know, to effectively create that adhesive hard material. But there are definitely researchers out there looking at, can you grind that all back down, do something to it, and then reuse it as cement and use it as a component to, in the same way that we use GGBS and PFA and potentially graphene in the future, can you use old buildings, grind them down and do it? I don't actually know how far that's got in terms of its research, whether it's got off the ground or not.
Even if you were doing that, that's still quite a lot of processing. That's
absolutely.
Not, I mean, it's better than taking brand new materials, but it's still a lot more energy to be able to reuse something than if you're taking it directly
and
out of the building.
I think... And somebody will go, that fact is incorrect, and it very may well be. But from memory, I think cement production makes up something around 8% of the whole world's carbon emissions.
Somebody said
to me, if concrete or cement was a country, it would be third place on the all-time producers after, I think, China and America. And the smart aleck is always, well, does that include the emissions for concrete from China and America? I don't know, but it's big. It's about context of scale of the problem, and I think it is worth remembering that 8%, if that is the right number, let's say 7 to 9%, that's a phenomenal amount of carbon being emitted just to build some buildings to live in, or offices for now people to not necessarily have to use. You know, it's a staggering amount of carbon.
Gosh, it's such a fascinating topic and such an enormous topic. I think we could do a whole podcast series on materials. We haven't even touched on algae, which was, I think that's another episode. Thank you so much for coming in and for sharing your expertise. It's been fascinating.
You're listening to the Building Talks Net Zero podcast with Chloe McCulloch and Elizabeth Hopkirk. So, as we said, we're recording this episode at the offices of Field and Fowles in Waterloo because we really wanted to learn more about this dynamic architecture practice. And making the very short trip from their desks to our microphones are Edmund Fowles and Fergus Fielden, who set up the practice in 2009, after which it quickly attracted attention for its thoughtful, sustainable and craft-centred approach to architecture. So welcome, Fergus and Edmund. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Just to give the listeners a bit more background, the Practice One Building Design's coveted Young Architect of the Year award in 2016, and this October, just 5 years later, you won the overall trophy, Architect of the Year, as well as Public Building Architect of the Year, which is no mean feat in 5 years. And that stratospheric rise has included, in that time, being shortlisted for the Stirling Prize in 2019 with the Western, that gallery at the Yorkshire Sculpture Park built in a quarry. You're also working at the Natural History Museum, on the National Railway Museum in York, and at Homerton College in Cambridge. You've just been showing us the beautiful faience tile that will be clad with. It's a lot to list off. It must have been a bit of a whirlwind. But let's start in the here and now. Tell us, where are we and why?
Thank you. Yeah, so we're sat in our studio in Waterloo on a city farm that we share with two charities, so Oasis and Jamie's Farm. And those two charities came together I think originally back in 2014, and they looked at the site and they asked us to have a look at it with them. And we did a kind of pro bono master plan, and we were advising them for a period of time. But it reached the point where we were putting a lot of time and effort into trying to help them with some ideas. And we also weren't being paid for any of it. And so we tried to find a way that it would mutually benefit them and us. So we proposed kind of coming in as a joint partner, building our studio here on the site, and offering them desk space, and then continuing to support them with the master plan, fundraising, and to oversee all the rest of the buildings on the site.
So I don't know if listeners can hear any sheep baaing in the background, but tell us a bit about what's actually on the site.
So we share the site with a number of animals and people.
So we're not just being rude about our team.
No. So we have sheep, pigs, occasionally even calves. We've got ducks, geese, lots of vegetables growing, and a whole range of community groups who come through the site and use the barn at weekends, evenings, and during the day. So it's quite an exciting kind of melee of different people and uses, and it's all in a beautiful little kind of oasis of greenery on the edge of Archbishop's Park.
And can you tell us a bit about the building for the studio itself? Because that's quite interesting as well.
Yeah, well, in the knowledge that all of these buildings would one day have to be dismantled, that was a really important part of our brief for designing the buildings. So each of the buildings on site here, the barn, the animal pens and the studio, are all demountable. And each building has a slightly different kind of level of refinement. So the animal pens are quite crude, and they're just simply lapped timbers, and the connections are quite kind of exposed. Whereas the studio has a sort of a developed language and quite kind of nicely jointed sort of flitch plates between columns and beams, but all with the intention that you can simply remove the pin connections, stainless steel pins, which hold together the frame. So the intention is that each member can be dismantled at the end of our life here on the site in Waterloo. The building will be dismantled, put on the back of a lorry, and we hope it will find a new home in the southwest, where we're hoping to open a second studio in the future.
Ed, you were telling me earlier what a lean building this is. Can you talk about that a bit more?
Yes, well, it's an amazing opportunity to design your own studio as an architect. And there's nothing like paying for your own building to make it. It forces you to be incredibly lean and efficient with the way that you're building it, and particularly given that it's a temporary building. So the building was really whittled down. It comprises of a timber frame principally. There's no kind of wet trades inside. There's no plasterboard or skim coat. It's all timber frame plywood that can be easily removed and dismantled. And the frame was actually made of Douglas fir, homegrown in this country, and fabricated by an ex-employee of ours who actually graduated from the practice and moved down to Devon and set up his own timber framing business called Timber Workshop. So the intention is that he'll come back and help dismantle it. But this approach has really kind of, it sits really close to our values as a practice, and has developed into an approach we call low tech. And by that we mean it's a kind of an approach to making buildings that have a very light touch, that are incredibly lean, use very low embodied carbon materials, and are durable and well detailed, and have a embody all those values really.
And have you measured the embodied carbon and the operational carbon that it takes to operate the building?
Yes, we have. Yeah, so we've recently gone through a process of making our operational carbon net zero for the business, and it's been a really important process to go through with our whole team, because we felt that we can't possibly offer our clients net zero projects without truly understanding what that means for ourselves, for our own business, and day to day what that means. So we've undertaken the Green Building Council net building accreditation, but also in terms of the embodied carbon of this building, due to the leanness of the frame and so on, it just has 290 kilograms of carbon per meter squared, which is at the lower end of the spectrum by comparison to the 2030 climate challenge that REBA's set.
You've described your philosophy as low tech. And that applies to materials and techniques, and often draws on local traditions. Can you tell us about a project that at the moment is exciting you in sustainability terms?
Yeah, I suppose the most live project from my perspective is probably Homerton College in Cambridge. And that project arrived in the office probably 5 years ago now, and the result of an open competition. And it was really interesting because we were actually able to bring the client to our studio as part of that competition process, and show them the studio that we're sat in now. And although it's a much smaller building than the dining hall that we've designed for Homerton College, it embodies so many of the values and the principles that we wanted to convey to them and in the project for the dining hall, such as the exposed timber frame, such as sort of having wonderful kind of connections out to the outdoors, passive principles of design, and you know, qualities of daylighting, north light, from which is filtered through the timber frame. Unfortunately, it worked, and we rewarded the commission. So that's now on site. It's at the closing stages on site. But in a way, it's whilst it shares many of the similarities with our values in the studio, it's also a very different building type. It's quite a complex building because it has professional kitchens, and it's a building that has to last a long time. The client said they wanted a building that would last at least 100 years, preferably 200 or more. And you know, many of the Oxbridge dining halls have lasted for several hundred years. So it was a challenge to kind of conceive a building that was highly sustainable but also highly durable. And so that really impacted the material selection of the building. So for example, we've selected a cladding material, this faience material, which you referred to earlier, Elizabeth, which has a slightly higher embodied carbon than, say, timber cladding, but is much more durable. And it was used in the Victorian tube stations, for example, because it has such durability. And it gives great identity to the dining hall. And the college have really kind of come on board with that journey of prototyping. And it really kind of ties in with the arts and crafts tradition of a building that we're neighbouring at the college, the Ibbotson building. And that was really kind of, I suppose, the starting point for the design of that building, really kind of developing a building that embraced the arts and crafts tradition of the Ibbotson building, communicated some of the kind of imperfections and those sort of handmade qualities that are so rich in that kind of period of building. So the faience was a perfect choice in that respect.
So thanks so much, Ed and Fergus, for your time. We've been sat in the warm in your lovely studio, and thank you so much for your time. But now I think you're going to give us a guided tour of the farm outside so we can see the animals.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's go. Okay, so we're just going to move from the walled garden into the farm. The whole site is set out in a very linear fashion with this central spine running all the way from the barn at one end, which is the most sort of public, social end of the site. The centre of the site where we're stood now has it's the kind of hard-working part of the farm. So we've got the animals on the right here, growing space on the left with composting, chickens rooting around, and then the outdoor kitchen as well.
I love it, the fact that you can just you can see the bridge along the way, and we've just seen a train go past, and then there's motorbikes and cars going down the road, and then on our left, on our right, sorry, we've got the sheep. And is that a goat?
Two goats.
It's particularly nice for some of the team, you know, if they're having a particularly stressful day. Not that architecture is especially stressful, but there are days, and they often come out and kind of sit on the farm or take a kind of lunch break out here, or get involved in some of the farm jobs and the garden as well, kind of always lots of weeding to do and leaves to pick up. And
so I'm going to feed the sheep because I think that they they're looking a bit hungry.
So we're with these very active goats who are very inquisitive. What do the kids get out of this? The one, you know, the school kids that you mentioned that come and visit.
So most of the kids who are visiting this farm don't have access to animals and outdoor space.
And so unlike in a kind of country farm where there's footpaths and much kind of wider access, most of these kids are living in places that don't have gardens and green space. And so this gives them all sorts of different opportunities. And there's also, I think, certainly for Jamie's farm and the children who are visiting the farm, they benefit because there's a very kind of healthy, simple relationship between people and animals, and there's all sorts of benefits that come with that.
Okay, well, thanks so much. We've really enjoyed meeting the animals. I think they're getting a bit too interested in us now, so we might head back in for a bit of warmth and a cup of tea. You're listening to the Building Talks Net Zero podcast with me, Chloe McCulloch, and Elizabeth Hopkirk. And now for Simon Wyatt and our regular Net Zero Jargon Buster session. This week, Simon has picked heat pumps. Now, this is a tricky topic. Simon, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
So, Simon, as usual, we'll give you a couple of minutes uninterrupted to demystify this particular piece of jargon, and then we'll come back to you with some follow-up questions. The floor is yours.
So, heat pumps are becoming more commonplace in conversation and are front and centre of the new government's heat and building strategy, which has had a very mixed response from the industry. Heat pumps are great as they don't use fossil fuels, which is ultimately where we're aiming to get to. They run on electricity and take an element of heat out of the surrounding air. This means that they run on an efficiency of around about 250 to 400%, which is much better than direct electric heating, which is only 100% efficient. However, one of the drawbacks is that they operate at different temperatures than traditional gas-fired boilers. Gas-fired boilers normally operate at 60 to 80 degrees, whereas heat pumps are more efficient, operating at lower temperatures around 40 to 50 degrees. This is fine when we're designing new buildings, which is where we can design the systems for these lower temperatures, and we also insulate the buildings to reduce the heat load so it's more effective. The problem is existing buildings which are not designed to run at these temperatures. They have heating systems, radiators that are designed to work at higher temperatures. Simply replacing the boiler with the heat pump means you won't get the same heat output from the radiators. So therefore, you can either replace all your heat emitters, which is very expensive, or you could potentially look to run your heating for longer periods. So instead of running your heating for a couple of hours, you might run it for 4 or 5 hours. This is fine for the majority of the year, but when it's really cold outside and you want the full heat output from your system, it might not be good enough. Alternatively, the other option is to reduce the heating demand before installing the heat pump by improving insulation and air tightness levels. This is the preference as it reduces energy consumption and cost. Operating costs are really important when we think about heat pumps as they run on electricity, which is 4 times more expensive than natural gas. So in comparison to a natural gas boiler, which is about 90% efficient, a heat pump would need to be about 400% efficient to be the same operating cost. Therefore, the optimum solution really would be to half the heating demand, and therefore we can operate kind of at 200 to 300% and offer a cost saving. The government strategy has come under fire for the scale of the subsidies for heat pumps. It's only providing enough funding for roughly 90,000 homes to be installed with heat pumps, compared to the existing 30 million homes which need to be decarbonised in order to meet our targets. The rationale from the government behind this is that the initial 90,000 homes will stimulate the market. It will grow demand and, through economies of scale, reduce the capital cost and bring it down to similar to boilers. Probably not all the way, but part of the way. The question is, where did the 90,000 come from, and is that going to be enough to stimulate the market? Also, the grant, as we know, is only for the heat pump. And as we've just discussed, it's not enough just to look at installing heat pumps. We need to look at insulation and air tightness requirements in order to make it financially viable and stack up.
Thanks for that summary, Simon. I found that really helpful. Let's unpack it a bit more. First of all, do you think heat pumps can really be the answer, given the figures you've mentioned?
It's a very interesting question. So we know heat pumps can provide an answer. Is it the answer? We don't know. But it's the only really viable answer we have at the moment. There's a lot of talk about hydrogen and also even compact nuclear. These are a long way off. We need to take action now. And the way we take action now is to electrify buildings, remove fossil fuels, and heat pumps, as we've just discussed, are 300, 400% efficient compared to direct electric, which is 100. So it gets us a long way there. It's a no-brainer for a lot of new buildings. So new buildings are fairly simple. We can design the buildings to accommodate heat pumps and work with those systems. The issue is around existing buildings.
Because there's 30 million of them.
Well, 30 million private homes. And then you also got all of the non-domestic. So every single school, office, hotel, every single building in the country needs to be decarbonised. And most of those have gas-fired boilers. And unfortunately, because they've got gas-fired boilers, they generally operate at higher temperatures than is ideal for heat pumps. So the question is, do you go in and strip all the heating systems out, all the heat emitters out, and replace it with a new heat pump system, which for commercial might be viable because they might have the funds available to do it. But for domestic, it puts a huge stress and ownership onerous on the occupiers.
And it's also a huge upheaval, isn't it? So it's the cost and the... I can't imagine that many members of the public, unless there was a financial incentive, wanting to subject themselves to that.
Yeah, I think there are a number of private dwellings which are doing it, but it's not en masse at the moment. And again, there are more complicated issues as well, because as I said, it operates most effectively at 40, 50 degrees. One of the main... heating requirements in homes is domestic hot water, so for your showers and your hot water use, and that's normally at 60 degrees, which is higher. So if we're generating hot water, generally the heat pumps are less efficient, or you can have two types of heat pumps which require more space, more capital cost. So there isn't a black or white answer on this, and again, ideally it should be run in conjunction with that insulation, which is even more upheaval. So if you're doing a major home retrofit project, which like I did last year, it makes sense to insulate the building, do those works, and then you can move over to a heat pump. But if you're just going, if you have no intention to do any works to your house, it's problematic, to say the least.
So what's the answer then? Because obviously there's 30 million homes that we have to look to make much more energy efficient. We can't necessarily wait for hydrogen to be the solution. Do we as a country decide to just go down this route and massively subsidise, or can we understand why the government's holding back? Because if it's not actually the right solution for a lot of homes, you can see why they're tentatively just starting with 90,000.
I think there's a lot of trial and error going on at the moment. So the government at the moment are doing a number of trial schemes where they are working with housing associations to look at their building typology, what is the best solution for decarbonising. We're helping with a few of those, where we're looking at how do you insulate. So do you externally clad, or do you insulate internally? And then what is the pinch point for changing over to a heat pump? I expect that once the findings of that come out, more funding will be made available for social housing, but the issue is around private housing, whether the government will actually go into that market and stimulate that market. But if they've stimulated the social housing market, hopefully the costs will go down so that more private owners can afford to do it. So again, it comes down to certainty. If the government commit to this and commit to retrofitting houses and installing heat pumps and make it clear to suppliers that they're going to do that, people will invest and move into that market.
So there's an issue of certainty. We've also got some of the leakiest homes and the oldest homes in Europe, I think, in the UK. If we don't have enough people with the right skills, and with your knowledge of our housing stock, this is like a ridiculous question really, but should we be knocking down all of our old buildings and replacing them with efficient new buildings, which would completely go against the retrofit first idea?
Again, it goes against retrofit first and the embodied carbon. So the issue we've got at the moment is the focus we have is on operational energy, but in reality our footprint from the built environment will mostly be from embodied carbon. But in order to move to a net zero carbon economy, we need to reduce our energy consumption. So energy in the future would be zero carbon, and that's probably not as long away as we It's not probably as long a way as we think. We will move to a net zero carbon economy, but in order to do that, we need energy efficiency, and then it becomes all about resource efficiency and material efficiency, which is the embodied carbon piece. So no, we shouldn't be knocking down the homes. There are proven ways to insulate them. There's the passive house standard, which is great for achieving performance and use for operational energy, can be done for retrofit. There's an Enerfit program, which is really good. And we should be promoting Enerfit more. Again, there's costs associated with it, but again, it will drive improvements. The only real elephant in the room is heritage and conservation areas, which are more problematic, but there are groups in the industry looking at how we deal with heritage and conservation. It can be done, but it has to be done very sympathetically.
Well, thank you, Simon. That was a really strong topic to end our series on. And I just want to thank you so much for your time over the last few weeks and for letting us use Cundall's offices as a podcast studio. It's been really great. So what's next for you at Cundall?
So I suppose now everyone's made these commitments, it will be helping our clients achieve them. And that will help us achieve Cundall's ultimate aim, which is net zero carbon 2030 for all of our projects.
So that's just about it for this week, and indeed for this series. We hope you've enjoyed all 6 episodes of the Building Talks Net Zero podcast. We've certainly enjoyed recording them and having such in-depth conversations with so many experts in the construction industry.
That's right, Chloe. We set out to talk to people at the cutting edge of the net zero agenda, and we've heard so many interesting ideas and solutions over the last 6 weeks. We started with Simon Alford, you might say at the sort of top of the profession, the new president of the RIBA. We've spoken to people quite early in their careers, like the engineer Clara Bagnall-George, who co-founded Leti. We've spoken to the activist Tom Bennett, who was arrested during an Extinction Rebellion protest. We've covered so much.
I agree. Also, not to forget, we've also spoken to mainstream politicians as well. So we've really covered a massive range there. But I think one thing they all have in common is a determination to contribute to the race to net zero. And also, we shouldn't forget our jargon buster sessions with Simon Wyatt at Cundall. He's thrown such a spotlight on some confusing terms around net zero. And hopefully, through those discussions, we've flagged up how you can spot some of the greenwash out there.
So, Chloe, it's been 6 weeks since we started this series. We started before COP. We've kind of ploughed through COP and come out the other side. What would you say has changed in that time?
It's a good question. I think, you know, when we set up the series, everyone's focus was on COP26 and the conference, and we sent our own reporter, Tom Lowe, up to the conference. So we had conversations in the lead up to the big event. And then we had conversations at the big event, and then we had conversations afterwards about what it all meant. And I think it feels different now. It feels like that was a very important thing to be involved with, that it was a chance for the construction industry and for the design profession to really focus on the issue and really draw attention to the importance, well, the urgency of the situation. But now, I think after the feeling of slight despondency and despair at what politicians can achieve at a world level, I think it feels like everybody wants to redouble their efforts in terms of what they can do in their professional life, what impact they can have. And certainly there's been, I think Maria Smith summed it up so well when she said she feels just as angry, but just as positive as well, and just as determined to make a change. So I think it's reinforced people's determination and maybe brought new people on board who perhaps weren't as focused as before.
Yes, and somehow it feels rather fitting that our last episode should be recorded in the studio of such a young practice. They're so full of enthusiasm. It's been really inspiring, and it's also been a lot of fun recording on a farm and getting to feed the animals.
I certainly didn't expect that when we started out on the series, so that's definitely changed. So, thanks to all of our guests in this series. We're taking a break for now, but the Building Talks team plans to be back in 2022 with more podcasts. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with the show, email us at newsdesk@building.co.uk or on Twitter @buildingnews. You've been listening to me, Chloe McCulloch, and Elizabeth Hopkirk. Podcast producer was Tarek Aziz. So that's it for now. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.